12 and 14 months, and for the crime of rape, if you're found not guilty by reason of insanity, the average length of stay varied between 22 and 24 months in the state hospital. Obviously, figures far less significant and far less lengthy than those of a person who comparably was convicted. I think you're all aware of the options that are available to you. Tinkering with the system and doing nothing are two of them that I hope that you reject outright. It seems to me that the choices really revolve around three different approaches that basically attempt to abolish the insanity defense or limit it so far as is constitutionally possible. That is the objective of the measure which the Department of Justice has submitted to you. We do believe that the proposal developed under the chairmanship of Representative Courtney is a sound effort at reform. In the intervening months, however, we've had an opportunity to study the language of that measure more closely, consult more widely with legal experts, read carefully Supreme Court decisions in the state of Oregon which have come down since that, and of course, finally, to examine the American Psychiatric Association's Blue Ribbon Panel report issued in December 1982. Let me highlight, although my testimony attempts at considerable length to develop the argument so that it can be illustrated in various ways, but let me highlight, if I can, the three or four major differences between the Department of Justice approach and the approach of House Bill 2075, if I can. First of all, let's make it clear that under all three bills that are before you, if a person's able to appreciate the criminality of his or her act and form a necessary culpable mental state, he or she is going to be found guilty under all three bills. That is not the difference. However, if a person is able to form the necessary culpable mental state, that is the end of the inquiry with respect to that kind of defendant as far as the Department of Justice bill is concerned. And if that element, the mental element, the mens rea of the crime is present, then that person who had committed the act and was able to form the intent would be found guilty under the Department of Justice bill. There would be no further reference to the Psychiatric Security Review Board. There would not be any conditional examination or any matters of that kind. There'd be no post-verdict consideration by the judge with respect to that matter. Under certain circumstances, however, those explained in page 8 of my testimony in the concluding two full paragraphs, there are certain defendants who would be found not guilty and released altogether under House Bill 2075 without further commitment, supervision, or treatment. This is at the same time both the major difference between House Bill 2075 and the other two bills and its major defect, because for that category of persons who don't fall within the certain specified area of crimes, there is no safety net, there's no special verdict procedure, there's no addition to be followed. They would, as we read the measure, simply be released and turned loose. Unfortunately, at least some of these persons might be among the most dangerously mentally ill persons, those, that is to say, who are unable to form a criminal intent at all because of the seriousness of their mental disease or defect. We believe that this committee should fashion a bill that accounts for what happens immediately to the person who is, in fact, so mentally unbalanced that he or she is unable to form a criminal intent at all. And we suggest that those persons should be categorized not necessarily by the nature of the crime that they committed, but by their future dangerousness. In our bill, we believe that that is accounted for. We do not believe that it's accounted for in House Bill 2075. Let me get to the second area, and this is really repeating, perhaps trying to put in my own words, what Dale Penn has just testified to. One of the problems that we're attempting to deal with is to make sure that each of the measures is constitutional by saying that, no, it's if not unconstitutional, at least inhumane for the criminal justice system to deal with someone who is totally incapable of forming a criminal intent. And we subscribe to that view, not just on constitutional grounds, but on grounds of appropriateness. It is not appropriate for the criminal justice system to be dealing with people who are so mentally unstable that they're quite literally not capable of forming a criminal intent, although something must be done with them. At the same time, however, attention has to be paid to what tests you use to determine whether or not there exists a criminal intent. Our bill attempts to do that by providing a specific definition by specifying that mental disease or defect, for purposes of determining whether you can form an intent at all, includes only an extreme mental disease or defect which completely eliminates the person's capacity to form and possess the required culpable mental state, which is the element of the crime. Now, if there is no definition to that, if there's no definition to what the court's inquiry, what the jury's inquiry is in forming an intent, then House Bill 25 could create precisely the same kind of psychiatric disputation in the course of trying to determine whether or not a person had a criminal intent, as it does right now in the current law in trying to determine whether or not the defense of mental disease or defect applies to excuse the person's behavior. Now that point is important enough that I think it's worth trying to say in another way. It could be that if 2075 were not appropriately amended, and since it lacks a definition of what constitutes intent or mental disease or defect for purposes of finding intent, that you could bring in all of the psychiatric baggage, all of the legal jargon, all of the, in fact, unscientific jousting amongst experts that is presently used in the insanity defense itself in determining simply whether or not there existed an intent to commit the crime. Now, I don't believe that House Bill 25 intended to do that, but I believe that the way the measure is worded, that would be the consequence. It would be precisely, as I understand Mr. Penn's testimony, the result which Idaho prosecutors are now worried about because they failed, apparently, to define the circumstances under which mental disease or defect applies to negate intent when they purported to abolish the insanity defense altogether. So what I'm suggesting is two things that we have done in the Department of Justice bill. Number one, we have supplied a definition of the kind of mental disease or defect that negates intent in our bill itself. That definition is explicit. And secondly, we make no apologies for it. We've tried to avoid the wishy-washiness of the current definition that includes substantial capacity, ability to conform, and so forth, that might get judges and juries right back into this fruitless and expensive battle of the experts that characterizes the insanity defense right now. I think I've testified briefly at least to the problem of what happens to people who are released altogether under House Bill 2075. That's dealt with briefly in our testimony on pages 12 and 13, and I think the committee is fully as capable of reading it as I am reading it to the committee. Mr. Chairman, we believe, in fact, in summary, that we've attempted responsibly to address measures which fall within the policy guidelines and fall within the policy determinations of the interim committee bill. We believe that the insanity defense has been abused. We believe it's needlessly expensive. We believe it deprives the system of its credibility. We've tried to formulate for you a system which does genuinely attend to the problems of those who are mentally ill by giving the court immediate recourse for civil commitment proceedings and so forth, without releasing a large number of people who are demonstrably not fit to take care of themselves and constitute a threat to others without further judicial or administrative supervision.
Thank you, Dan. Questions from the subcommittee? Representative Hill.
Yes. Dave, on page 2 of your testimony, all of the people who have been received the admissions because under this defense, and maybe you didn't have the statistics on recidivism, how much, as I see for Oregon, there's a little over 400 people who have been admitted to the institution under this defense.
There's another more startling figure, Representative Hill, if I can give that to the committee, because I glossed over it in my opening testimony. As you all know, probably from the 19th century, Oregon was a McNaughton state. It was a McNaughton state. The legislature proposed to change it in 1962. Then Governor Hatfield vetoed the bill. So it didn't come into Oregon law until 1972, criminal code revision was effective. In the last six years of the life of McNaughton in the state of Oregon, 1965 to 71, there were 44 successful not guilty by reason of insanity defenses in the state of Oregon. In the following 8 years, I'm sorry, following 10 years immediately after the enactment of the revised model penal code version, there were 734. That is well over a tenfold increase in the successful use of the insanity defense, notwithstanding the fact that the 6 years is discounted for the 10 or so. That's an astounding change in admissions to the state hospital that came by virtue of the change in the legal test used for the insanity defense. Now, I can't tell you precisely how many of those persons are recidivists, and indeed, there could be some charlatanism in deciding that, because in all fairness, one would need to ask, is a recidivist someone who simply re-enters the mental health system again in the form of another commitment, although not having committed a violent act on another person, or is it a person who enters the criminal justice system? Because we don't have a common definition of what that includes, the data is only impressionistic. And I'm giving you my good faith memory that it's somewhere in the range of 25% to 30%.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
David, do you have the statistics on the incidence of the use of the defense in total cases?
No, I don't, Representative Myers.
Is the comparison, you indicated it was successfully used 9 times more often in Oregon than was it New York?
Yes.
Which has a comparable standard?
Yes.
Is it being asserted in terms of proportion of cases, all cases, is it being asserted substantially more often in Oregon?
I'm guessing now. I'm trying to make an educated guess. In a way, it's a chicken and egg problem, because the more successful time it's asserted, the greater that makes it. And Mr. Penn makes a very good point, which he can make more eloquently than I, but it's not merely the number of times it's asserted, it's the number of times that it's threatened to be asserted that runs up and escalates the cost of the system of preparing cases internal to district attorney offices and so forth itself. But I don't know that anyone's really measured that. Mr. Rogers has done as exhaustive a survey of this kind of thing, I suppose, as anyone. He may have some figures on that.
If I could just briefly respond to that, I think that they won't be able to find statistics on how many times the defense is asserted or investigated or paid for by the state, particularly now that the state is picking up the costs of prosecutions in the counties. Where any time you have a murder case,
maybe.
Oh, part of them, yeah, that's right. Part of our witnesses, and no. That is a substantial cost. And many defense attorneys, when you are looking at murder or A felonies or serious crimes that involve a lot of time, they feel that it's a malpractice if they don't at least have the defendant examined. And even if there's many times there isn't a lot of evidence there in the case to suggest anything about mental disease or defect, and you have a lot of jockeying for position by the prosecution and the defense without definitions in the law, that same jockeying and that same battle of the experts and the same problems that we have now will go right into the mens rea element that we have now in the mental disease defense area.
Let me say this also, Mr. Chairman. There is some evidence that a fair number of commitments to the state hospital come by way of stipulated pleas rather than from outright findings by the court or by the jury of not guilty by reason of insanity. It's also a fair observation, I think, to say that courts, when they are sitting as a fact finder, probably find the existence of the elements of the defense more often than juries do. But one of the reasons that pleas are stipulated, obviously, is that the very expense, both to the public defender, if that's the case, and to the prosecution, may be so great, fighting it all the way through, that a stipulation that the person will be going to the jurisdiction of the PSRB may be the most effective way to put the person in secure custody, at least for some period of time, even though it's obviously not analytically clean, and the ultimate costs of commitment are terribly expensive.
And what are the principal factors that district attorneys would take into account in whether or not to recommend accepting the stipulated plea?
Okay. I have some real problems with the present law because, and this is one of the key concepts of why the law is wrong, there is an aura of expertise and a tendency by judges, lawyers, prosecutors, and defense attorneys to abdicate their responsibilities anytime you get into a mental disease situation. We look at a case and we say, well, I don't know what's going on inside this man's mind. That's something the psychiatrist must tell me. And juries take the same point of view. And yet, when you look at the study by the American Psychiatric Association that recommends that there needs to be reform, that there can be no expertise at all in this area of being able to conform someone's conduct to the requirements of law, that there is no guidance whatsoever in this area of substantial capacity, that it is open, that in fact there is no expertise there. The American Psychiatric Association and the study that the Attorney General and the Executive Director of PSRB has cited states that they feel the proper definition should be the one that the Attorney General's bill really proposes, dealing only in extreme mental disease situations and not dealing with personality disorders or antisocial conduct so that you don't get involved in these Twinkie defenses that a man who ingests Twinkies has a personality disorder which should excuse him from some type of murder. Those are problems, and unfortunately, that's the Dan White case in San Francisco, and it's on record. That's what happened. Prosecutors, I think, have just taken the point of view, if the psychiatrist tells me that this man should be committed, perhaps that's what I should do. And what we are saying is that the law is so loose and has no guidance that there is an immense area there for misuse and misunderstanding and commitments and use of the defense when it's totally inappropriate. I prosecuted a case out of the forensic unit of the Oregon State Hospital where, by definition, every person there is committed because they're not responsible. And yet, one of those inmates is found to be responsible of assaulting other people there. My witnesses were other people who have been committed because of not responsible, being not responsible. And yet, I interview these people and they tell me, yeah, I was up in Portland, I was arrested on kidnapping, I didn't want to go to the penitentiary. I thought the best way to get out of this was go to the state hospital. I've been here for a couple of years, I hope to get out pretty soon. Maybe the way the parole system is, I should have gone to the joint, quite frankly. But that particular witness was one of the best witnesses I've ever had in a case. There is great misuse of the defense and a great abdication of deciding when it is proper. Psychiatrists and the American Psychiatry Association are telling us we don't have any guidance. Please change it. This is a legal concept, it's not a medical concept, and you as legislators and you as lawyers are asking us to do something that we cannot do. We're really just giving you a gut feeling. How would a sane criminal do the same act, or do I think he should be in the hospital or in the prison? Because I don't have any medical tests, I don't have any real guidance to tell you whether substantial capacity was involved, whether he can appreciate criminality based upon substantial capacity, or whether he can perform conduct. So that's a problem, and I think that perhaps there are times when district attorneys have stipulated when upon greater scrutiny they perhaps should not have. And I think that's perhaps an education thing that our association is involved in. But it's a problem, in a real core problem in the law as it presently is written.
Chairman, I'm told by a Lane County prosecutor that he had a recent case in which a psychiatric expert testified on the psychiatric manual that the person deserved to qualify for the defense because he had something that, if my memory is correct, was called a transactional situational disorder. He was asked to translate on that stand, and he said, that means a bad temper. But that's a kind of variety of things that that are thrown at the people who are in the prosecutorial ranks every day when this defense is urged.
Other questions? Okay, thank you. We will undoubtedly be seeing both of you.
Actually, it wasn't a question. I was just going to refer to the committee. I haven't read through all these materials, but in what Felicia Gniewasch passed out, there is an article that was authored by Jeff Rogers, Joseph Bloom, and Spiro Manson that has some figures on page 3 of it about the rate of success maintaining defenses in Oregon. And it states, it's on page 3, it says less than 1% of criminal cases result in verdicts of not responsible. And then it's got a table of the rates of successful insanity defenses in Oregon, felony cases from 78 to 81. That's just a response to your question.
Although I had indicated on the agenda that we would not take any other testimony, I'm somewhat loath to not make a little more headway given the workload of this committee. If there are persons here who are prepared to testify today, we're going to do that rather than come back. Jeff, I'd like to take a very short recess. It could be most right now, but then if there are others who would like to present comments today rather than come back, we'll run on a bit longer and try to get some of your comments in. I'll have a sign-up sheet put out so that you can sign up.
I'm going to cut off.
Subcommittee will return to order. Mr. Rogers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jeff Rogers. I hold two jobs. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney, and I'm also a part-time adjunct assistant professor of psychiatry at the Oregon Health Sciences University. I was not intending to testify today, but merely to listen, but I'm glad to try to present some additional information that would be of assistance to the committee.
Jeff, I might interject and say that although if you wish to go ahead now, we certainly welcome your comments. You know, if in subsequent hearings you wish to come back and present additional comments, we certainly will give you an opportunity. I don't want to put you on disadvantage today. I just saw you there and didn't know whether you might want to say some things while you were here.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think the thing that I can do that might be most helpful today is just to refer you briefly to some of the material that's been distributed to you. I think among the material that Felicia Kniewasz handed out is a paper of ours, draft March 1983, titled Oregon's New Insanity Defense System, a Review of the First 5 Years. That is an overview of the statistics that apply to this subject of the Insanity Defense and the Psychiatric Security Review Board. We have tried in that paper to take no positions, but merely to present facts. This legislature has an advantage over most legislatures in the country, and that is it has a great deal of information available to it about what really happens in the insanity defense. And the reason for that is what this legislature did in 1977. Which was create the review board, create a very tight system with close supervision and excellent record-keeping possibilities. And that's allowed a number of studies to be made of this system. And perhaps if I just point out the kinds of things that are in that packet, it may answer some of the questions that were being asked about the rate of insanity defense use, the number of commitments, the recidivism rate, and so forth. I think that basically this summarizes most of the information we do know. There are still a number of things we don't know about this system.
What are the principal things we don't know?
What we don't know is we don't have a precise idea of the rate of raising of the insanity defense. Those things which require collecting statistics from county courts, such as how often do you raise the defense, are hard to gather. That hasn't been done. We do have some estimates in here based on what data is available as to how often it is raised, how often it is successful, and so forth. The other thing we don't know is at the far other end of the system, and that is what happens to people who are discharged totally by the board or by the court. There has been no follow-up study completed of those people. Me and my colleagues at the Health Sciences University are in the middle of such a study where we are looking at computerized criminal histories of those people who were discharged and released with no further supervision. And we should, in a matter of months, have some results of how those people have done. But we do know just about everything there is to know about all those people who successfully use the defense, what happens to them, where they go, what kind of new crimes, if any, they are charged with, and so forth. We have a great deal of information, and that is summarized in this document, along with we point out the categories of information that we don't yet have.
You're talking, in terms of new charges there, about persons who are under the jurisdiction of the board?
Yes.
And are on conditional release?
Yes.
Supposed to be discharged?
Right. Or occasionally, people who have escaped from the hospital have been charged with new crimes, but under the jurisdiction of the board. Those who are under the jurisdiction of the board, those who have successfully used the insanity defense, Oregon knows more about than any state in the country, bar none, because the review board is so efficient in keeping track of them and keeping records. Many states are in the situation that Oregon was before 1978. They didn't know where those people went after they were released from the hospital. They knew as long as they were in the hospital, but not afterwards. The review board knows where they are, not only in the hospital, but afterwards. And that brings me to one point. I think it's fair to say that Oregon, once again, beat the rush in dealing with the insanity defense. A number of the problems that have been alluded to today existed prior to 1977, and that was the reason for creating the review board. In 1977, other states weren't worrying anywhere near as much about the insanity defense as Oregon was. Oregon has already dealt with many of the problems that are just now being looked at for the first time by other states post-Hinckley. You look at some of the statistics in this paper, for instance, on page 2, it shows the rates of successful use of the insanity defense. The Attorney General, a minute ago, referred to the skyrocketing use of the insanity defense. It's now on its way down in Oregon. It's changed since the review board. The Attorney General referred to the skyrocketing rate of forensic patients in the Oregon State Hospital. That's on its way down, too. It went up until the creation of the board. It went up for a year after the board. It's now on its way down and is stabilized. In a very real sense, this state, with the efforts of this legislature, this legislative body several years ago, has solved many of the problems. And I guess my overall question is, what really is the problem now? What is it that needs to be fixed? And I am not clear on what needs to be fixed. There are statistics in here about recidivism, and a list, for instance, of all of the people charged with new crimes, what their new charges were and what their original charges were, what happened to those charges, a number of tables which I hope were relatively easy to go through. On recidivism rates, it shows that of 295 people who have been on conditional release at one time or another under the board's jurisdiction, 39 of them, or 13%, were charged with new crimes. Of those, 18 were charged with felonies. That's 6%. So 6% of the 295 people who were on conditional release over the last 5 years were charged with new crimes while on conditional release. I don't know how that compares to parole, but I suspect it's pretty good. It also highlights the fact that we believe that we have found, and believe it's accurate to say, that the insanity defense system is in Oregon is run by consensus. We prepared another paper, which I expect to be published shortly, which I haven't provided to you, but I would be glad to, called Insanity Defenses Contested or Conceded. It analyzes in more detail this agreed-upon fact that over 80% of the successful insanity defense cases in Oregon are agreed to by the prosecution. And we've heard Mr. Penn discuss that a little bit. But when the district attorneys or the attorney general says to the effect that we have too many of these kinds of defenses, one can't help but ask why does this, why do the DAs then agree to more than 4 out of 5 of them? And I'm not sure it's really a fair reason to say it's too expensive. I think most of us who are concerned about the criminal justice system would like to see more money put into the criminal justice system. And here we have a system which seems to be working pretty well and undoubtedly costs somewhat more per capita than the corrections system. But is that good or bad? By the same token, we have statements made about New York State. We have more insanity defenses in New York State. I think that's correct. We also have more clean air. We have more honest politicians. The question isn't do we have more or less of it. The question is it good or bad? And it's those kinds of evaluations that I think need to be made by this committee. And I hope that this material we've submitted, although lengthy, and I realize all of you have much too much to read already, might be of some assistance. It's broken down by kinds of questions that are specific, that are frequently asked about the insanity defense, with, we hope, fairly brief summary answers to them.
I think it would be helpful if you could I'd like you to review the testimony of the Attorney General as presented today. Do you have a written copy of it?
No, I don't. I was going to get a copy.
And I'd like to ask if you could be prepared when we have further hearings, if you could respond rather specific, in a rather specific, focused way to the points the Attorney General has raised.
I'd be glad to
pose on you for that preparation. Representative Lomberg.
Well, my question was really was going to get to this, Jeff. I think you raise, you know, the rhetorical question that in part needs to be answered by this committee.